88.1 KFCF in Fresno and online at kpfa.org. The time is 2 p.m. Up next, the Visionary Activist Show.
Daniel there? Well, well, how quirky. Oh, team, welcome allies to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey, in this quirky, interesting field. I flew back from California to Washington, D.C., where I'm back in the literal and metaphoric swampiness of our nation's capital. Thanks to all kind allies in California, the wonderful beings at KPFA, the Apprentice Program, a special shout-out, and all the great future leaders of KPFA, and also all my hosts and wonderful people at Open Secret and the Wu Wei Tea Room and the kind people in Bolinas. Yay. So, yes, we are going to be connecting with my splendid guest, Daniel Jamario. Again, we are praying to the mercurial airwaves. He will be joining us from the Philippines, so pray for our connection. He is just back from Göbekli Tepe in Turkey and Gulang Padang in Java, as well as Bali. So we'll be reporting on that, as well as the beautiful Mars-Venus sky story on Earth as it is in heaven. We certainly have journeyed past the utility of conventional reporting and news. It is mythic news time to tease again the heartening, guiding mythic story into our bones and blood as we go. So I love a wonderful, quirky British friend on Facebook said, "When life gives you demons, make demonade." Yes, that's what we're doing. I did give a pretty adorable summer solstice talk, but it was not recorded because apparently we're going prehistory when there was no recording. So I will be touching on some of the major themes and some of the themes that Daniel and I will be honoring as he joins us from the Philippines. Inshallah. He does mention that one of the big stories in the Philippines was the Pope's encyclical is pretty amazing, and we can go, yes, yes, grumpy, grumpy, church bad, however, many great things. And in the Philippines, they were particularly inspired. It's a big news story that one of the many, many cultivated sources that Pope Francis quoted was a 8th century Islamic Sufi mystic. And we go, ooh, go Pope, Pope be smoking, Pope be smoking, Pope be dreeing his weird. And again, as encouragers and discouragers, we discourage, and then we encourage over here, oh team of public dreamers conjuring the desirable world into the molecules of our reality. Let us all indeed, you know, dedicate to being public dreamers. Let's remember that part of the miracle and beauty of radio is in keeping with its ancestral intention, that the purpose of ritual magic is to spiral into group human mind, expanded wisdom and tolerance. And that's why radio is so fabulous that way. So we do have much to honor. Again, a perfect moment. A wonderful board op is connecting connecting with many, many, many beings. So let's honor some of our themes. One of the things that is so beautiful overhead each night, everybody, it is democratically available to everybody whenever it's not cloudy. You know, after sunset, we get to see Venus blazing in the west, so close to Jupiter, and they get closer each night, until July 1st when they are conjoined pretty, pretty darn close. It is a fabulous sky story, beautiful on a just observatory, you know, astronomical level, but we can see it, we can feel it, we see it, and we want to align with it, you know, in many activities on the Earth. Certainly, we have Daniel, you say? Aha! We have Daniel. Yeah. Yay! Just as I'm doing Venus, Jupiter, and how we can see it on the Earth, and let's tease that. And I was telling them about what you said about the Philippines and the Sufi mystic. So we welcome our great ally, Daniel Jamario, joining us from the Philippines by the miracle of telepathic technology. And you are just returned from Göbekli Tepe, Turkey, and Gulang Padang in Java. So yes, you were on the Syrian border.
It was very interesting being there. There's a town called Urfa, although the current name is Songurfa, meaning the Great Urfa. They consider themselves to be the oldest town in at least in the the Western world. I'm not going to Middle Eastern and Asia, not including Southeast Asia. They go back 12,500 years. They believe themselves to be the descendants of Noah, after what is now being clearly seen as some event that occurred about 13,000 years ago that created quite a upset on Earth with the melting of the ice and possible cometary strikes and all of that. But anyway, what's really great about being in Urfa, a lot of people were scared for us going there, and it's only 30-40 miles north of the border where there's actually a fair amount of fighting going on just now. This town is welcoming to everyone. I mean, they have every version of Muslim. They have the Kurds there. They have Christians there. They have secular people there. A very welcoming, and it's just remarkable to see that there still exists a place that has that flavor of welcoming everyone and not having any sort of hatred toward anyone, and still existing right in that area, which is also the town that's called the City of Prophets, where Abraham was born, and where Job was born. It's also right next to it is Haran, the seat of the Sabians. So therefore you have the seven temples of the planets, the temple of the sun, the temple of the moon, Haran. We went to the ruins of Haran right there in exactly the same area. The Sabians, of course, you love the Sabian symbols, and it's from the Sabians that comes that name, from Mark Edmund Jones and Dane Rajar, that were heavily into the Sabians, which was a spiritual tradition entirely based upon the connection with the planets and the stars. And it seems to be very strongly connected to what was happening there. And Göbekli Tepe.
I do use the Sabian symbols in their myriad forms. I know that the impulse for metaphoric imagery for each degree of the zodiac goes way, way, way, way back. But most of modern astrologers use the ones conjured by Elsie Wheeler and Mark Edmund Jones. I confess, why did they call it Sabian symbols?
Because of the Sabians, which was lasting for thousands of years there, right there in Turkey in Anatolia, was this group that rejected the monotheism the Azeti and some of the other groups there are the descendants of these same people. They still follow the traditions of honoring the planets. The Sabian society came from that particular inspiration, that the Sabians that built these temples to the planets right in that particular area, that seems to be a direct link back to what was happening in Göbekli Tepe. So that's where it came from. I mean, it's the one known historical tradition which you could say that astrology was the centerpiece of their spiritual way of life.
That's interesting. I thought the Sabians lived in Petra, Jordan, but never mind that.
Haran. There's two different. There's different. There's different. The Sabians all existed also. There was a cult of them in Egypt also, in Jordan. But the Haran was the seat, the origin of that Sabian group. And it lasted for a very long period of time. We saw lots of the inscriptions from there that were taken from the ruins that are in this fabulous. I really highly suggest anyone to travel to Urfa. They just opened a museum there. And so it's the most phenomenal archaeological museum I've ever been to in my entire life, and I've been to a lot, that has a lot of the artifacts from Göbekli Tepe and the surrounding area there, including from Haran and the Sabians and things like that, including a complete mock-up, beautifully done, of Göbekli Tepe. You know, so the Turkish archaeological people are totally into this, even though the German archaeologist, Klaus Schmidt, who did the archaeology for 25 years, unfortunately passed away last year unexpectedly. But the work is continuing on there in a big way. It's capturing the imagination of the local people there, even though it's somewhat still not known that much in the U.S. It tends to be ignored because it overturns the assumptions of the mainstream archaeologists and anthropologists.
Because I want to, you know, here we are, and then also backstage speak with you more, because I've always wanted to go there, and maybe I too will take people there next year. But
Turkey is phenomenal as well. You know, what's happening there politically is really interesting. But if you take the later Islamic overlay over the top of it, I mean, it is really the centerpiece, Anatolia, of the mother goddess religion.
Yes,
it's from coming down from the Altais and centered in there. I mean, it's, everywhere there are indications of the mother goddess temples there. Cybele was the original one that they, and then later that got overlaid with Diana and Artemis, but originally it was Cybele.
I do love it. I mean, Turkey, and as you say, welcoming is intrinsic underneath everything in the Middle East, and part of our dynamic, of course, where there's hyper yang, uninitiated Mars, death frenzy in the world, let us go to Venus and to the roots of what is beautiful, certainly in the war zones. I didn't know that Cybele was also from there. We have a wonderful colleague, Baris İlhan, who's a Turkish astrologer, but I remember her showing a great arch from southeastern Turkey, which showed the planets in their sign of exaltation, reminding us that, I mean, there was Venus in Pisces and, you know, Mars in Capricorn, showing us that these are very old affinities going way back, and that southeastern portion that's so exciting. And then as we tease it now, the pertinence, as you had been saying backstage, very rare to have a Sun-Mars conjunction, Mars in the underworld on the solstice. Let's honor the Mars-Venus stories. And in Cancer, it's about knowing our own history, certainly, and the archaeological realm of language and history, and, you know, taking it back far enough to finding something with which we're kin and inviting it to come alive again. But speak to us of the Sun-Mars conjunction at the solstice, which is occurring straight up overhead in California right now.
We're sort of in the central portion of this celestial drama that is unfolding. We go back a few months, and that was when, in the current dance between Venus and Mars, and I want to be clear here that we're referring here not to the abstract expression of this, but how we can actually see it with our senses.
Right.
So there would be a few months ago that Venus and Mars were beautifully seen together for a brief period of time in the evening sky. And that was a certain way in which Venus and Mars can dance with each other visually. So they were together in the sky, in the evening sky a few months ago. And then Mars sort of disappeared from the world stage to enter into about a 3-month period of being in the underworld. What we mean by the underworld is that it has disappeared from sight because it has gotten too close to the sun. The ancient visual recognition of that would be the planet is moving closer and closer and closer to the horizon, and then it disappears, which in ancient reckoning was entering into the underworld. So that is where Mars is now. Mars will rise as a very dim morning star on August 5th. And that begins the third phase of this. I was talking about the central phase now is Mars in the underworld and Venus still sort of dazzling us with Jupiter in the evening sky. But Venus is soon to disappear, to go into also the underworld for a short period of time, and then rise as morning star August 22nd. What happens on August 22nd is immediately Venus will see Mars. Mars will have come up in the morning sky on the 5th of August. Venus rises on the 22nd of August, and they're only 10 degrees apart. And this begins an over 3-month time period of Venus and Mars within 10 degrees of each other in the morning sky. If we look at the conjunction of Venus and Mars back in the evening sky a few months ago, and we then project forward to the last Venus-Mars conjunction in November, it's a 9-month time period. And we find this this sort of 9-month imagery a lot in the when we look at the planetary cosmology, kind of a birthing, the amount of time it takes to bring something to birth, a gestation time, 9 months. So we have the Venus Mars conjunction in the evening sky that happened some months ago. Now we have Mars in the underworld going through a profound initiation, as Venus is going through a profound initiation in conjunction with Jupiter, dazzling us near the star Regulus, yeah. And then they meet up in the morning sky. And as you, years ago, shared with me, that amazing piece from William Irwin Thompson,
yes,
for the reinterpretation of the Rapunzel story in light of cosmology, that is the portion of the story of Rapunzel where she reunites with the prince. And she's pregnant, actually, or has already had a kid at that point.
Twins. Wait. She has twins. Very important.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes, has twins, yes. And that the tears fall down from the eyes of the Mars, of the prince, and they quote-unquote live happily ever after.
Well, a little bit. I think just to tease it into now, it's actually it's a brilliant by William Irwin Thompson, you know, analysis of the fairy tale Rapunzel, reminding us that when we go, oh, a fairy tale, it's how humans passed on their intimacy, their botany, their science knowledge, you know, packed into these stories, and the Rapunzel, or Rampion, you know, is the story. It the plant grows up like a tower and sends down 2 golden braids, but yes. The Mars figure is blinded, cast down by the witch, blinded by thorns, wanders in the wilderness. I want to toss this back to you. Wanders in the wilderness, becomes a beast. Rapunzel has given birth to twins. Very important how the one becomes two, becomes three, and it is her tears of compassion when she finds the rough beast Mars, her beloved, who's had a hard time, that fall into his eyes and heal his sight. Now I want to toss that back to you as really pertinent. We have Mars, go into the underworld and just rethink all the Mars stuff. Just rethink all the Mars stuff, and then can gain vision. Mars and the Sun are soon to trine Neptune from Rapunzel, from the feminine heroine's tears of compassion, and then they do live happily ever after, kind of. Okay. That's all important. So I love the Mars in the underworld, especially right now as it's transiting Elizabeth Warren's Sun. And Uranus, may she be even woofier, woof, that, Mars at zero Cancer, the solstice degree, which is the lowering of an old flag, ha-ha, Confederate flag, and the raising of a new one, yay life, that's going on now. And Mars in the underworld, I love the gods. When Hercules was laying waste to the world, they sentenced Mars to go to the underworld to learn knitting and weaving and to learn how to repair what he'd been tearing asunder. So you said it was very rare for the Sun and Mars to be conjoined on the solstice. Remind us of the and furthermore, yeah. Mars is quintile Uranus. It's an applying quintile, irresistible eloquence. Again, Mars, the template of the hero. The hero protects life, and bringing this alive in a new way. Now back to you.
Well, yeah, the sort of the mythic and ceremonial overlay that that we've placed on this portion of the Mars journey when Mars is in the underworld, about 3 months every 26 months this happens, is that it's the time period where the masculine principle in both men and women goes through the profound initiation, which is kind of like a sun dance or an okipa, where there, if you look at it from the spiritual perspective, it's when the masculine principle will go into a place of humility, of surrender, of going through something like, you know, suffering, but for the people, not just for himself. And has to, as you say, it has to rethink what is this, what the hell is this masculine thing, you know, and having to go through trials and tribulations and letting go of the attachment to who he thought he was. However, the underworld also has a shadow side. So you have the transformation that can happen from it. And when Mars rises as morning star and encounters Venus, we can project onto that the idealism of that happily ever after, that sense of Venus and Mars in collaboration, the masculine and the feminine once again as soulful and spiritual and heartful allies with each other. But also we would have the other kinds of things that could happen with Mars in the underworld, the holding on to the worst excesses of the astrological mystery school of Cancer. I love my clan, but everybody else I hate. Or, you know, the provincialism, the way in which we might understand some of these limited phenomena that we're finding, you know, politically and in the world, and of course in the United States with the dramas that are unfolding regarding sexuality around Confederacy, you know, and everything else. So it's like the shadow side of Cancer is there right along with what is represented by the high side of Cancer, which could be thought of some of those things contained in what the Pope has brought forth.
Yes.
Which is like looking at things globally. You know, we're all one people on one planet, and looking at it as this is where we can actually, how can we have a safe place for our children? What would benefits for the seven generations to follow? I mean, that's, we could say that's good Cancer or healthy, healing Cancer as opposed to the shadow side of it, all of it that are transpiring right at this time period.
Right. I want to honor our late great colleague, Jade Jacobs, for his great astrological joke. A Cancer is just a Scorpio in a house coat. It's so great. I mean, because all signs have their PR. Like, I'm just a Cancer. Here's some soup. I want to just bring into play that, you know, Chiron, little planetoid that really does exist, between Saturn and Uranus, between discipline and wildness, stationed yesterday at 21 plus Pisces. The Sabian for that is a prophet walking down an industrial slag heap with a new set of guidelines, and we go, Yeah, what a good idea. Stationing. Because as we look around the world, there's, you know, Johann Saar, who was just sentenced to death in Boston for the marathon bombings. There's, you know, Dylann Roof, we go, whose father gave him that gun on his 21st birthday on April 3rd, 2015. We do not have, Chiron was the quintessential mentor, you know, these are guys who had bad mentors. You know, so I just want to kind of bring in the mentoring and the Pope, who really is a pretty good pagan, you know, coming down the mountain going, you know, fossil fuels are immoral. I mean, he was, you know, powerful. And again, the complexity, I do love this, excuse me, this article by Elizabeth Renzetti in the Globe and Mail, brilliant article. Because she says, as an angry former Catholic, as a Catholic who's still angry at the Church on a number of fronts, I was prepared to pick holes in Pope Francis's lengthy treatise, but instead came away quite awestruck. He has hit this one out of St. Peter's. It is a remarkable document, really remarkable. But what she says, there's been a hole in the climate change argument, a hole of grandeur or compelling narrative or moral authority. The densely packed reports of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change are vital, but they do not stir the heart. We'll come back to Leo. The weasel words of politicians are designed to drive us to drink. And then just a little bit. She says, no UN report will ever say, as the papal encyclical does, that rather than a problem to be solved, the world is a joyful mystery to be contemplated with gladness and praise. And then he takes greed and capitalism and fossil fuels to task and says these are moral issues. So I think that's a Jupiter narrative, you know, grandeur, stir the heart kind of dynamic that we want to honor in all of us. So there.
And as we go into this third phase of the Venus-Mars dance in the evening sky, just before Venus sinks into the underworld, will be Jupiter and Venus with Regulus. Regulus, the heart of the lion.
So it's
a fabulous stellium of symbols right there. Just before she goes through her shift into a different expression of the feminine when she rises as morning star, August 22nd. I might want to just quickly interject for those that are listening to this that might say, well, how can you use the planets this way? I want to invoke the memory of Herta von Deschen, who's really behind this particular view of cosmology, which is that the actual experience ceremonially and viscerally of the planetary dances and the seasonal changes and the starry patterns is what inspires ceremony, mythic expression, an archetypal shift and change from one time period to the next. So it's by tuning into these things that it inspires our imagination, inspires our myth-making ability, and our ability, as Jung put it, to dream the myth forward, which is what we're trying to do here together. I mean, this is really what this magical interweaving is, which is to dream the myth forward, inspired by the dance of these planetary beings here at this time.
Yeah, and also just again, so everybody, you can see it, you know, and as Daniel guides us, because he's such a great guide for, you know, again, the ancient form of actually seeing the thing, not just on the computer. You know, after the sun has set with Mars in its embrace, going down into the underworld to remember and redefine heroism, and that's part of what we're aligning with, and coming into its trine with Neptune, may positive Mars assume cultural narrative leadership in a good way. All right, but we can see Venus and Jupiter after sunset. Again, as Daniel says, Venus will soon disappear. No, it'll be very sad. I'll get over it. Okay, and Jupiter. And then if you follow that arc, Venus, Jupiter, and then visually just follow that arc, you'll see Regulus right in that curve, that beautiful, you know, again, a restoration of a kind of intimacy with the sky that all of our ancestors had, criminy's sake. We go, there we go, okay, Regulus, the royal star, very beautiful. So again, it's according to latitude, I suppose, when Venus disappears, but around, you said, soon disappears, so, and then she comes back up August 22nd, pretty soon. All right, she's spending some time in the underworld. We'll be
this, this portion of the underworld is where Venus is passing between the Earth and the Sun. So it's a very fast underworld. We call it the interior underworld, and it only lasts about 7 or 10 days. And again, depending on whether you're in the southern hemisphere, northern hemisphere, how low your horizon is, the ancients always came up with a ceremonial time period. Some said 7 days, some said 8 days, but it's a very quick passage where she'll be really bright in the evening sky, and then she'll be gone, and then maybe a week later, you look toward the morning sky, and there she is again. The heliacal rise, and that's exactly the point where she'll spot Mars. Oh, there's Mars. How did you do on your journey? You know, like, did you learn what you intended to learn when you were in the underworld? That's also the very same thing we could project onto the Inanna de Muzi story. Same thing, you know. It's like, and we'll go back a few months. They meet together in the evening sky. Venus says to Mars, "It's time for you to go in the underworld." And he goes into the underworld, and they meet up in the morning sky. Well, did you learn? learned what I learned. You know, can we actually be collaborative equals at this point to actually have relationship in the world that works? You know, things like that.
We're going to take a very short musical break. Pertinent, I'm pretty sure it's from Kith and Kin, something we use often. Cool of the day because it seems so pertinent. Our wonderful guest, my longtime colleague Daniel Jamario, is joining us from the Philippines. Don't go away, Daniel. We're going to take a very short musical break, and here we go.
So fair. Well, you may live in this garden if you keep my grasses green, and I'll return in the cool of the day. Now is the cool of the day. Now is the cool of the day. Oh, this earth is a garden, the garden of my Lord, and he walks in his garden in the cool of the day. Then my Lord, she said unto me, do you like my garden so pure? Well, you may live in this garden if you keep my waters clean, and I'll return in the cool of the day. Now is the cool of the day. Now is the cool of the day. Oh, this earth is a garden, the garden of my Lord, and he walks.
Oh, beautiful, dynamic listening audience. That is Kith and Kin. You can find them on YouTube singing Cool of the Day, a beautiful song by Jean Ritchie, who died recently. Wonderful songstress. Again, homage to all of our ancestral beings who've contributed guiding beauty. That is particularly great. Our wonderful guest today is Daniel Jamario. He's joining us from the Philippines. I know that, according to listeners, the audio was cutting in and out at the beginning, but I think we're getting steady. And Daniel's just back from the Turkish-Syrian border and Java as well. Many great things, and we are diving back into the Sun, Mars, and Venus story. And you're still there, right?
Absolutely. You sound really clear.
Excellent. That'll do. So that's really wonderful. So, yeah, so we're going, you know, it is available to everyone to be Pope-ish and available for the Pope to be animistic-ish, because he is, you know. And, yes, we criticize the imperfect everywhere, you know, but we encourage the beautiful. Encouraging is such a good word, feeding the heart. And wherever you want to go, but it's such a powerful time right now. I also want to bring into play that, you know, what I find so beautiful about now is not only is it the solstice and Sun Mars, and we can come back over all these things, and heartening for our tragic Earth circumstance, but Venus and Jupiter getting close together. But it is Jupiter at 20 plus Leo, drunken chickens, is the image, trining Uranus at 20 Aries. So I've been very enthused, and still am, regardless of all of the tragedy and kerfuffles, small and huge. It's as though the backstage divine has said, oh, humans, God, we're going to have to either kill them or heal them. All right, let's try healing them first. Let's make the power of story and the synchronicity field even stronger. Let's have Jupiter and Uranus, like greased lightning, the path openers kind of unfurl before us. I don't know. Is that part of your shared enthusiasm, Daniel?
It's, actually, I find myself hugely enthused about what is happening, taking place now. is getting that sense of what's happening in Turkey, just as far as the modern world, the rejection of the, in a big way, of the attempt of the president over there to put in a theocratic government, and it was overwhelmingly rejected. The desire for it to be a more secular place is continuing big time there in Turkey. What he wanted to do was to move it further to the right of theocracy and to turn it into a federalist state where he would have the same kind of powers that works in the American government. and that was soundly rejected. There was a really good sense of that. But looked at from a different angle, what I'm really enthused about is the phenomenal amount of breakthroughs that are happening in the last, just in the last 6 months regarding the discovery about our history. You know, our history, actually. I mean, who are we really? That what we've been told about who we are as dominators, as warlike beings, feeding into the capitalist greed frenzy, is turns out to actually not be true. That for a far longer period of time, there was harmony and peace, particularly during the time period when we were gatherer-hunters. I like to say gatherer-hunters rather than hunter-gatherers, giving credit to Rhian Eisler there. That there was actually more gathering than there was hunting, quite frankly. And it was the time period where there was a balance between masculine and feminine. And there was almost no evidence of there being like armies. Even at Göbekli Tepe, which did have a hierarchy, there were those that were like the star priests, the great designers of the megaliths. But there weren't armies. There weren't fortifications. I mean, that all came later. This Göbekli Tepe thing, I mean, it's beyond imagination, really. I mean, it met my expectation and more when I went there. They've only excavated about 1/20 of it. And still buried under the ground are, which they've seen on, sonar, radar, or whatever the techniques they're using now. 30-foot high monoliths that are still under the earth, that have come from this, great temple that was built 12,500 years ago, and that is conclusive. That's all radiocarbon dated on using different techniques. It really existed. I went there. I saw the T-shaped stones. I saw all the snakes and the fox and the boars, and it's kind of like an ancient zodiac. And even more remarkable is that it was tuned in to where the North Star was 15,000 years ago. The whole emphasis on that whole site is toward Deneb, toward Cygnus the Swan, toward the great bird that skims the milk off the Milky Way, the Saraswati, in India is the way they would perceive that. And it's like standing at the top of the world tree. You have the Cygnus the Swan, Deneb, the only star that was ever the North Star, right smack in the middle of the Milky Way, perpendicular to the horizon. And that's where there's a central hole in Göbekli Tepe that's pointed right to where that star was at the time when that particular way of viewing the cosmology was primal. And that entire area, it's like they're just barely excavating. I mean, there's hilltops, like mounds where the structures are still there. So it's just inspiring to get that sense of a greater sense of our history, that hunter-gatherers could build these phenomenal temples well before the mainstream archaeologists ever thought they could do it. They said, well, you need to have cities first. You need to have agriculture first. Now, it appears that things like agriculture were invented from places like Göbekli Tepe. So it's kind of a whole story we've been told about our history is like turned on its head, upside down. Then, to go even further afield to Java, a place called Gulong Padong, which is potentially the lower levels of it, 22,000 years old. They've only radiocarbon dated back to 3500 BC now, but it's this astounding pyramidal structure that is pointing toward a great volcano right in about 4 hours from Jakarta, high up in the mountains. That was also inspiring to actually get the sense that our continuity as a people goes way further back than this lie that it only started 5,000 or 6,000 years ago, and it started as sort of a dominator kind of thing, which divided people into classes and castes and all of that, which seems to have come way later. So I'm really inspired to finding out that actually who we really are as a people, our DNA, the far longer history of ourselves as a people, is not the way we see the world today. So far, this is not progress. I mean, it's like an aberration. I like to think of the whole situation as a triple aberration. It's what happens when you put monotheism, hierarchical patriarchy and patrilineal family descent together to get the current predicament.
Well, so since we get to do, you know, with our dynamic listening team, you know, on air radio, why not? Pluto does provide us with a metaphoric all-purpose composting alchemical cauldron. So, you know, so maybe should we put all theocracies into the cauldron? Are you up for that?
And have it be a quadruple aberration?
Sure. Well, anyway, I'm up for it. You know, whoever wants to join me, going. I think theocratic government is a bad idea. So into the cauldron, there we go, and ladle out democratic animism again. Reverence. When you mentioned the great that we're not dominators, for a long time Neil Douglas Klotz, great Aramaic scholar and biblical scholar, on the show often, but he said the most criminal translation in the Bible, in the Old Testament, was that word dominion, and God gave humans dominion. And he said that's not the word at all. It was more like stewardship. And the Pope just came out and said that. He said that word is wrong. It is not dominion. It is not dominance. It was stewardship and protection. And we go, again, go Pope. Yes, we hate the Pope, the Catholic Church. Okay. But we go, yeah, that's brilliant. So, yeah, and you had been correcting me or guiding me backstage, when I said, well, all I'd known, that was written about Göbekli Tepe. Yes, exactly, and I do want to go there. That when the early reports were coming out going, yes, fantastic, monoliths with, foxes and snakes and clearly kind of Garden of Eden-like. And then the narrative, which you can disabuse us of, was that then they had gone to agriculture, and once they'd gone to agriculture, they engaged in human sacrifice, and then sometime later they were like, oh, this is a big mistake, and they buried it. Now, you said you didn't hear any of that part about the
agriculture. No, definitely not. In fact, some of the early reports also included Klaus Schmidt's idea that they kept digging, they're going to find the skeletons of the rulers. It was that old view that, the pyramids are like the place where you put it's only for burials, rather than as a spiritual temple of initiation and enlightenment. And they haven't found anything like that. So some of the earlier narratives are no longer existing. This was brought up in one of the videos that I got from a Turkish archaeologist to put together something beautiful on Göbekli Tepe. It was brought up about, what about this human sacrifice thing? And
right.
And he says, we've seen there's no evidence of that. Certainly, if you go back to the Vedas, and there's some connection between the way the elite seemed to be there at Göbekli Tepe, similar to the earlier Vedic understanding of the hierarchical priests, they did at that time period do a sacrifice. I mean, it was well known in animism that you do sacrifice. That they still do that here in the mountain province of the Philippines. They have a wedding and they sacrifice a carabao or water buffalo and that kind of thing. So in that there is in animism that tradition of doing sacrifice, but the aberration of human sacrifice, no evidence of that there whatsoever. No trace of such a practice in Anatolia as far as I could see. So basically the Turkish archaeologists are just amazed that for the most part the U.S. ignores U.S. archaeologists and even German ones, even though it was Klaus Schmidt himself who was German, was doing the excavation. They sort of ignore Göbekli Tepe because they have to think about things in a way that they're not used to, so let's just ignore this. And it's even more pronounced when you go to these places in Southeast Asia, where we ignore what's happening there. When they discovered the 50,000-year-old cave paintings in Sulawesi in Indonesia that look exactly the same as the ones in France. We don't want to put too much attention on that because it rewrites our own history. Well, gee, it needs to be rewritten now, doesn't it?
Well, that's great. No, I don't know about the 50,000-year-old cave paintings in Southeast Asia. I must go there, too, but you're guiding us telepathically to do so. Yes, I just know the 30,000-year-old cave of forgotten dreams. But that's great. And then when you speak of Turkey, and I've only been once with a great team, Paul Stamets, Andy Weil, we were watching the eclipse, and Donald Abrams, hi there, and Clint Werner, many a great team. But it was clear, and from hosting wonderful Guneli Gün, wonderful Turkish author on radio many years back, but she said just before signing off, she said, you know, in pre-Islamic Ottoman Empire, in pre-Islamic Middle East, the predominant deity was she-wolf. And everywhere throughout the Middle East was an azure blue flag emblazoned with a female alpha wolf's head on it. And I'm like, whoa, let's bring her back. And when I was in Syria, I mean, I asked people about that, going, what about that? And they were like, yeah, we have that in folklore. Haven't thought about it in a long time. And, but as you say, you know, Turkey, again, the idea of these places of incredible confluence, like, you know, Europe meeting Asia and the Mongolian horde sweeping in. And one story, and I'll hand it back to you to guide me and correct me, but, you know, is that they sweep in with Mongolian shamanism, and then they go, well, what's the game here? Oh, the game's Islam, so we'll put on a front of Islam, but underneath is this magic thing. And you're saying, you know, but Mongolian, I mean, it's still pretty scary in Yang, but you were saying that underneath that is a kind of deeper positive feminine dynamic also swirling into Turkey. Is that what you were saying?
Very much so, and I'm actually sort of stunned that you would bring up She-Wolf and then relating it to Anatolia, and since you did invoke Chiron before.
Yeah.
You know, the original constellation of Chiron, Centaurus, was visible and very prominent in stellar understanding back at that time period, Centaurus being the constellation of Chiron. And in the earliest renditions of Chiron, this is before he was pictured as having this spear or lance with a dead animal on the end of it, ready to sacrifice it on the altar. All those constellations are up there. Before that, and this is according to Robert Graves and some of his sources, that it was actually Chiron with a thyrsus dancing with a she-wolf.
Uh-huh.
And now we're adding to that the fact that prior to the sort of the patriarchal Greek, later Greek Zeus cults coming in and taking over, there were more temples dedicated to Chiron in Anatolia than any other deity. That information came to me from Demetra George.
Oh, you know,
so basically Anatolia is a Chironic area. And this she-wolf thing, now I did not know that, but I do know that what you brought up regarding that. However, there's a lot of information about this wolf imagery from the research of Andrew Collins. That's who I went to Göbekli Tepe with in his most recent book, Göbekli Tepe, tracing the origins of the people who came in there, basically down from the Altai Mountains. And this is way before we're talking about the Mongolian hordes coming down. I mean, we're talking about a transmission of human beings that are sort of like the crossbreed between Neanderthal and Cro-Magnon that produced a richness of understanding that survived the Ice Age and then came down and sourced civilization of Göbekli Tepe. That seems to be the pieces that are coming together right now.
Yes. That's great. No, and also just as a corrective, because so many, again, in the New Age realm of non-historic research, it says, oh, you know, Chiron, the wounded healer. And we go, yeah. That's where often people park in their worship of, you know, martyrdom, going, oh, I'm more sensitive. Anyway, it's true. Right. It's not nothing that he can heal where he's been wounded, but the rest of the rich mythology is don't stop there, you know. And part of what we're doing now, again, and may it be in everyone's bones and blood, we have the Sun and Mars overhead in California, and you know, everywhere, somewhere. But it is, again, a reanimation of the historic dynamic with its beautiful quintile, irresistible eloquence to Uranus and Aries, to bring old history alive in a fresh, new way that points us to actual democracy. You know, is it equal man and woman? Is it equal Mars and Venus? Is the trickster, truthsayer, playful, welcome? Excellent. We ladle it out of the cauldron? No. We throw it back in, no matter how sacred, quote-unquote, the thing is. You know, everything into the cauldron measured against, is it beautiful, equal, and useful to us in guiding into an actual democracy now? There we go. So that's kind of perfect. I love Dimitra George's research. Because part of also, even some weeks back when I had, you know, wonderful, super sharp, sharp, smart, lefty, intellectual Henry Giroux on, but we were honoring going, yeah, it's the rewedding of Mercury and Neptune, but, you know, to have actual knowledge and intellect and research and scholarship, these are good things, you know, wedded to Neptune, dreams, vision, mysticism. We go, no, it's a very important thing to put them together. So, yeah, the likes of yourself, Dimitra George, people who are, you know, actual scholars, you know, come on, team, let's know something. Let's get smarter. So Andrew Collins, I will check out his book, definitely. So right now, you know, for all, you know, I love you that you're hugely enthusiastic about, you know, much, the Turkish rejection, well, the modern rejection of theocratic government. Excellent. Well, what was the, and there you were on the Syrian border, but it did not feel scary? I mean, you could hear bombing of Katani, no? I mean, Katani's right over there.
No. There were actually, Urfa, this ancient, the place, you know, the birthplace of Abraham and Job and close to Haran and the Sabians and tracing their lineage back to Noah. Basically, they welcome everyone. There were 200,000 refugees. In this city. It's a city of over a million people, actually. And they welcomed everyone. The refugees are taken in. That's the only sign you have that there happens to be a conflict, you know, like 40 miles away, at the border. No sense of feeling unsafe, whatsoever. I mean, it was just, plus, there's this fabulous new museum they just opened there. We were like the probably the first Westerners that actually set foot in it.
Wow.
What was so inspiring also was that guess who was filling the museum? Is that basically they were children. I mean, basically the schools were having, 8-year-old, 9-year-old, 10-year-old, let's go to the museum, you know, let's find out about our history, you know, not preventing them from knowing any of this, but it's like really open-minded they're really proud of it, actually, proud of this awareness of going back that far and who they really were as a people, you know, so it was very inspiring. We should embrace that open-heartedness, I felt really good.
That's wonderful. And also I think, you know, again, as you speak it, and also as it is above in a guiding, astro language, you know, that real history, excavating, you know, back is indeed liberating. And because it's George Orwell's birthday, I just want to do a smidge on that. You know, George Orwell wrote 1984, you know, pretty good, and Aldous Huxley, Brave New World, but they did take most of their ideas from brilliant Eugene Zamyatin, who wrote perhaps the best dystopian novel maybe ever in, I think it's 1917-ish. Eugene Zamyatin wrote a novel called We, and George Orwell borrowed a whole lot of that, George, and Aldous did too. And then just briefly, because I want to toss it back to you, because it's so powerful. So Eugene Zamyatin, writing We, brilliant. Brilliant novel. He has a dystopian, you know, again, 1917-ish. It was banned in Russia for decades because it was so radical. It has a domed city, a technologically domed city where everyone is imprisoned and there's rumors of nature outside. And there is a fantastic woman. I think her name is something like N238. And she is talking to the hero going, you know, you have hair on your hands. You're not as imprisoned as you think. You have wildness, and she does dangerous things. She has dangerous ideas about nature and beauty and a world that is outside the dome, and she smokes and stuff, you know. And she's like, come out into the... Anyway, it's a brilliant novel. But it is very pertinent to us now. So George Orwell, good novel, but you should attribute, really. Attribution is an important and wonderful thing. And I would just guide everybody to Eugene Zamyatin's brilliant novel, We, as really pertinent. It's got a kind of a gloomy ending, but it's us to write a better one. So, okay, wherever we want to go in this, we have our precious...
Yeah, that thought there about it's up to us to write a better ending.
Yes.
I mean, from my perspective, that is one of the main functions, if not the main function, of the school that I have, the Shamanic Astrology Mystery School, which is to participate in these mysteries and to assist in reweaving the story. To get direct inspiration from the planets themselves, connecting back to our ancient history, and then on the sort of inspired by the idea of Renaissance, then re-inspire, reanimate a new story that has to do with this collaborative union of masculine and feminine, that has to do with a new cancer, you know, a new version of cancer, which is the global humanity on one planet, and we have different tribes, different clans, but we can collaborate and get along and make the whole planet work for everyone. Creating new stories based upon the same planetary interweavings that the other stories were projected onto before. It's our responsibility to participate with this and to redream the myth, and to collaborate. It's part of what some people refer to as the evolution of God. That it's kind of like if we think of some master plan here, well, it requires our participation in order to dreaming it forward.
Excellent. Exactly. No, that's right. Up to us to write a better ending. Yes, yes. We're trudging through Act Four, where the blocking characters seem to be winning, the sociopathic dingbats destroying creation. But Act Five is what we got to earn by looking bravely in the face of all that is dire and tragic and sad, and the incredible loss of life our species is occasioning. And as a listener ally, Kate Henke, said, remember, you know, we are the 1%. As a species on this planet, lest we just wag our finger at the 1% rich people going, turn that finger around, it's all inclusive. And again, our inauguration of a guiding meta-narrative that is all inclusive. Is there anything, I know we're going out on this and we want to do much more too, but you have Moon in Capricorn, Dylan yeah. Roof has the Sun in Aries square, the Moon in Capricorn, and there he was attacking Mother Emmanuel Church and the beautiful, incredibly beautiful, cultivated nine people who really were a Moon, Neptune, Uranus conjunction. I mean, embodied pragmatic mystics doing good in the world. But what would you have mentored him in 1 minute?
Oh, my God.
Or not.
It's that revisioning of Capricorn. That what you thought Capricorn was, of course, I wouldn't necessarily use the word Capricorn, but who you respected as your elders were the wrong ones.
Yes.
You needed to respect the circle of grandmothers. That basically it's the circle of life, the grandmothers, the elders that have created the beauty and wonder on this planet, for being concerned about the generations to follow. You have, there's a whole different group of elders that you should have learned from.
And you know, it is spooky because Chiron stationing at 21 Pisces, prophet coming down industrial slag heap with a new set of tablets. That's Dylan Roof's Mars, 21 Pisces. And we go, no, wrong mentors. You know, again, summoning in, and we go, no, no, you know, be the mother, not kill the mother. And may we wish a complete repenting change of heart in him. He said he almost didn't kill those people because they were so nice. So let us spiral forth a blessing of may almost get stronger. And all that. Any, we're on our way out in 2 seconds, Daniel. Any blessing to the world? Here we go.
Be with Venus and Jupiter and Regulus, and tune in and let them inspire you to expand your heart into a place of a feeling of wholeness and self-love.
Excellent. Let us.
Hello, I'm Veronica Faison.
I got my mojo working, baby. And I'm gonna try it on you. Yeah, I'm gonna try it on you.
I'm inviting you to join me on my new talk show, The Week Starts Here. Sunday night, 7:30 to 9 p.m. on KPFA. Together, you and I will tear down barriers, make new friends, and build bridges into the future one week at a time. Sunday nights will never be the same. The Week Starts Here, 7:30 to 9 p.m., right here on 94.1 KPFA.
I'm a mojo working. Oh, yeah. I'm a rooker lady working.
The animals trap till the cages fall.
Friday, July 3rd at 7 o'clock p.m. You're invited to join us live on Full Circle. People nationwide will be beginning their 4th of July weekends, kicking off on the 3rd with barbecues, fireworks, and cargo shorts. As many prepare to celebrate the independence of America and commemorate freedom, Full Circle is taking a moment to slow down and talk about incarceration. The issue of incarceration and treatment of prisoners is paramount to a nation that fancies itself a world leader. We'll feature conversations with formerly incarcerated individuals, as well as people who work with and serve men.